And we are rolling. Hi, Michael.
Mark, how you doing?
Good. So this is Mark Goldberg with the UN and Global Affairs blog, UN Dispatch, speaking with Michael Cohen. Michael, you have a few affiliations. What are they?
My main affiliation is I'm a senior research fellow at the New America Foundation, and I'm also on the board of the National Security Network.
Okay. And and you're also a contributor to the excellent foreign policy blog, Democracy Arsenal.
That is right. I'm a contributor there, which, of course, Democracy Arsenal, also run by National Security Network.
Exactly. So we are going to be speaking today about a report that you recently co-authored about U.S. democracy promotion in the world. And also, you know, if for readers of Democracy Arsenal and readers of UN Dispatch and people of this, you know, and the UN Plaza audience should definitely be reading that blog. Which hopefully they are.
Of course.
Know that Michael's been writing a lot about counterinsurgency recently, so we'll talk about that in the later half of the conversation. But first things first, in your capacity as a senior research fellow at the New America Foundation, you co-authored a report called, and I'm reading it now, Revitalizing U.S. Democracy Promotion, a Comprehensive Plan for Reform. So I guess maybe I'll serve it up to you, Michael. Why would U.S. democracy promotion perhaps be in needing of reform?
Well, you know, this report kind of came a little bit out of watching the past several years of how the U.S. did democracy promotion, and particularly in regard to the Bush administration's freedom agenda, which I think many of us would agree was not as successful as it was intended to be, or certainly we might have hoped it would have been. And I think the report tries to lay out some of the problems that we see with the freedom agenda, the Bush administration approach, but also I think some of the longstanding challenges to democracy promotion, to effective democracy promotion by the United States. And I think, you know, the big thing, the two big issues that sort of jumped out to me working on the report, that the failures of the Bush administration really was letting the rhetoric get ahead of reality, of the extent to which democracy promotion was made out to be, at least in the second term, the key foreign policy priority of the United States, which I think always runs into challenges because democracy, you always have to balance interests versus values. And in many cases, the Bush administration talked a big game of democracy promotion, but they didn't always follow through. And of course, their own behavior, insofar as the look at Guantanamo Bay and wiretapping and torture, obviously undercut their message on democracy promotion. The second part issue that was raised, I think, by the Bush administration, their approach, was the extent to which democracy promotion became politicized. You know, democracy promotion theoretically is a long-term U.S. foreign policy objective. And yet it's consistently, and this is not just for the Bush administration, but I think throughout American foreign policy history, has been taken over by short-term considerations. And you saw many examples of this. I mean, I think the elections in Palestine when Hamas won. I think the elections in Egypt, again, tough talk toward about democracy in Egypt, not followed through when we need Egypt's help with various regional political issues. So I think that both of those, the report was really trying to figure out ways to how do we tone down the rhetoric and how do we depoliticize democracy promotion. And the third part also, I'd say, is that how do we get the foreign assistance bureaucracy to work more effectively? I mean, the funny thing about the Bush administration, one thing I will say, is they put in place probably the, I'd say, best foreign assistance program that we have right now, which is the Millennium Challenge Corporation, which is a program that really works off of an independent criteria. It gives aid to countries based on how justly they're governing, how much they are focusing on public health needs, on economic growth. In other words, it really does allow the countries to, in a sense, it decentralizes foreign assistance, has countries have more impact on where aid is going, but it also really conditions aid on democratic progress in developing countries.
Can I interrupt you there quickly? I'm wondering, do you know off the top of your head which countries have been recipients of the so-called MCC, the Millennium Challenge Corporation funds?
There's quite a few that have gotten assistance. I mean, I think some of the prominent ones, Morocco and Jordan, have gotten significant amounts. There was an issue with Nicaragua actually money being taken away. The compact being taken back, but there's about 30 or so countries, I think, that have gotten significant amounts of money from MCC.
And
but don't quote me on that.
How much are we talking about in the MCC account?
Well, the amount of money is not as significant as it should be. In fact, in the last budget, the amount of money for MCC was cut in half. And part of the problem with MCC has been that they don't give money away fast enough. I mean, this is an amazing complaint about U.S. foreign assistance. They don't give money away fast enough. But the problem has been that the MCC tries to work on a five-year schedule, a five-year program. These compacts are 5 years long. And they're intended to really work directly with the countries over a long-term trajectory. But the approach of I think of Congress, unfortunately, has been really to view this in a short-term manner. Also, the fact that this is a Bush administration objective has tended to undercut support on Capitol Hill for the program. But back to the original point, though, MCC was a good program. Middle East Partnership Initiative, another program coming out of the State Department. PEPFAR, the President's Global AIDS Initiative, all good programs. But all of them contributed to what is the fragmentation we've seen in the foreign assistance bureaucracy, where you've got different power centers. You've got AID, which has been really, I'd say, cratered as a development organization because it's basically relying on contractors and NGOs to do its job. You've got MCC over here. You've got state giving assistance. You've got DOD now doing 20% of development aid. You've got PEPFAR. You have all these different power centers. And so one of the things we looked at in the report was how do you end this sort of fragmentation? And our big our takeaway was you need to create a development assistance agency, a cabinet-level agency that basically is responsible for all U.S. development and democracy assistance. In fact, for all U.S. foreign assistance that isn't political in nature. And I think that came really away from seeing how do you, again, get back to the three issues I raised earlier, how do you depoliticize aid, how do you cut out the fragmentation, and how do you make it more effective?
I guess, and you call this new agency the sort of Department of International Development.
Yes.
There have been, over the last few months, it seems that the aid community, the sort of foreign development community here in Washington and in NGOs in New York and elsewhere sense an opportunity now to press forward this kind of agenda, an agenda that you outline for foreign assistance reform. And you're now the second report I've seen that calls for a creation of a new cabinet agency, a group called, I'm sure you're probably familiar with, called the Modernizing Foreign Assistance Network.
Yes.
Calls for a global development cabinet level agency. And incidentally, I had Ray Offenheiser of Oxfam on this program a few months ago to talk about that. But I mean, it seems to me that that this is a worthy goal and a worthwhile goal, and many European countries have their own cabinet level ministers for development. But it seems like an awfully tough political fight to have to create this new department. You seem to think it's a fight worth having, though, correct?
I think it's a fight you have to have. And I'm not. I recognize the challenges, and if you look at the way the Obama administration has approached these issues to date, it's not a lot of reason for confidence, frankly. They haven't appointed an AID administrator. They haven't appointed an Undersecretary for Democracy, Human Rights, and Labor. MCC has also not gotten a new administrator. There's a lack of focus, I think, from the Obama administration on these issues. Nonetheless, there has to be a recognition that our civilian agencies, and I think this is a recognition, by the way, that goes across political spectrum. Our civilian agencies have been seriously demoralized and seriously negatively affected over the last 8 years. They are not functioning as well as they can. The AID has become, I think what everyone would agree, nothing more than a contracting agency. And the military is taking over a lot of these responsibilities. So you kind of have to begin this debate somewhere. Are we going to have civilian agencies that are focused on doing long-term development? Are we going to have civilian agencies focused on promoting democracy? And if we are, we can't continue down the road that we've been going because the system just doesn't work and doesn't serve the needs of the people that are trying to help. And it doesn't really, I think, serve the taxpayers effectively either. So I think that while maybe, it might be a hard hot hill to climb, and I'm not going to deny that, to get to a cabinet-level agency, we have to start this conversation somewhere. I think, frankly, the best place to start is a recognition that AID has been seriously undercut. They've lost mm-hmm. capacity, and that capacity has to be rebuilt.
And you know, it seems to me that you probably know the history of this deeper than I, but most of the capacity was lost in sort of the 80s and early 90s, right?
Oh, this is a bipartisan effort. Oh, absolutely.
Right.
I mean, the Clinton administration,
I think AID at its height was at its height during the Vietnam era, where it had you know, tens of thousands of more employees than it does now, and employees, you know, out in the field, like you said, most of what it does now is issue contracts.
Absolutely. I was at a conference a few weeks ago, and I heard that AID has, I think, a dozen economists on its payroll and less than 10 engineers, which is for a development organization is really crazy. Mm-hmm. But I just to your point really quickly, I mean, this is a bipartisan effort in which I think the Clinton administration deserved a lot of blame for this by agreeing to fold AID into state, which I think really is one of the reasons why we've had such a problem. When they have to share resources with state, inevitably development is, because there's not a real constituency for it in this country, is really going to get affected negatively, and I think that's what's happened. I think also what's happened is that the state has taken over a lot more of assistance responsibilities. You know, it's a funny sort of situation. People don't trust AID. They don't trust AID to be an effective implementer of programs. That's one of the reasons why MEPI, Middle East Partnership Initiative, was created in state. At least that's my theory on that, at least. It's one of the reasons why MCC, I think, was created as a separate organization, as sort of a quasi-government corporation. And I think that, you know, you have to sort of make a decision. Do you think AID is important? Do you think it has a role to play? And if so, then let's find a way to fix it. But if not, then let's do something different. But you can't continue down the same road you're on at this point.
I guess, how does your new Department of International Development avoid what seems to be a big problem with U.S. foreign assistance? And that is, you know, each, you know, members of Congress, they're the ones who, in the end, you know, appropriate funding for USAID and for foreign assistance more generally, and many members of Congress have their own parochial interests that they'd like to see implemented. You know, USAID or development might not have a large constituency here in the United States, but you know, there are certainly diaspora communities
sure.
that that influence, you know, how their member of Congress acts. And so, you know, it seems that you have all these different these different interests at play, and it's hard for me to see how creating a new cabinet level agency somehow gets beyond those sort of the you know, members of Congress pursuing their own parochial interests in foreign development assistance.
You're always gonna. I mean, this is a real problem. Obviously, the earmarking to death of AID has been happening for a very long time. I mean, one of the rationales behind MCC and one of the reasons why I think MCC is a good program is it creates a situation that would kind of, I don't know if it would end completely, but would certainly diminish this earmarking. Because what it basically would do is say countries aren't going to get money if they don't fulfill certain criteria. So I think the more money that you can move through MCC would be a more effective, be more effective assistance, but I think it would be one way of undercutting the dynamic that you talked about. I think the other thing you need to do is think about how do you delineate different types of assistance. In other words, you know, how do you differentiate between political assistance, which basically is geared towards short-term political goals, whether it be the aid we give to Israel and Egypt as part of the Camp David Accords, whether it's aid we give to Pakistan to fight Al Qaeda, which has also not been used terribly effectively. I mean, the way, and to my mind, that money should be going through the State Department, and AID should be really focused on these sort of long-term foreign policy objectives. And there needs to be to do this, you'd have to rewrite the Foreign Assistance Act. And I think one of the elements of how you rewrite that act is you make it more difficult for Congress to basically demand that AID fund this priority or that priority. It's a difficult goal to achieve, but, you know, again, unless you can get past this notion of basically the sort of parochialism you talk about, you're still going to have AID not operating effectively as it should be.
Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering, you know, do you have any sense, you mentioned this earlier, but still we're something like, you know, we're recording this on Wednesday, April 15th, and this is something like 86 days into the Obama administration,
right.
And they still have not appointed a USAID administrator. I mean, do you have any idea why, what the holdup is and why that hasn't happened?
Well, you know, there's been a lot of names bandied around. I think a lot of it has to do with the vetting issues that were raised by, obviously, the Daschle nomination and the Guider nomination. Mm-hmm. But I worry a little bit about it because the signal that it sends, and there may be good reasons why it's taking a long time. The signal that it sends, I think, to the development community, to AID, which already has very, very poor morale, is that this administration doesn't take development and democracy that seriously. And I think that...
There's also, during the campaign, one of Obama's promises was to double U.S. foreign assistance from something like $25 billion to $50 billion. And then as, all the crisis hit, the financial crisis hit, candidate Obama and vice presidential candidate Joe Biden both, admitted that, one of the things that they're going to have to move more slowly on now is fulfilling that right. promise. And that seemed to me sort of an early sign that there might be, rough roads ahead for promoting for the sort of cause of global development within the administration. But go on.
Well, I mean, obviously resources are important, and there's a bill up on the Hill right now to, I think, triple the number of AID officers, which I think would be a very important step forward. But look, I mean, part of it also is leadership, and there's a sense that, and not just because of the lack of an AID administrator, that the Obama administration doesn't take these issues as seriously as I think some people think they should. Certainly when Secretary of State Clinton went to China and really kind of didn't push push the Chinese as hard on human rights as some would have liked, there was a sense, I think, from some people that this is they're not going to be as rhetorically demanding on democracy as they should be. But and that might not be such a bad thing. Maybe we need to ratchet down the rhetoric a little bit. But when you're in China and you're Secretary of State for the United States, you need to talk about human rights. It's something that we value, something that we consider very important in our relationship with China. So I think that it's not just a question of resources, it's a question of tone, it's a question of the importance, the extent to which you value this as a priority for U.S. foreign policy. And I just don't get the impression at this point that there is a lot of focus in the administration on our civilian agencies and the damage that's been done to them over the past 10 or 20 years.
Although I think to be fair, it seems again we are only 85 days in. Seems like a little. What's that?
Yes, we're only 85 days in, but AID.
Yeah, it's still taking. I think maybe the personality of the administration is still taking shape, but it's not an encouraging sign.
It's not, and I think
an AID administrator.
It's not again. It's not just that position. I think it's a general sense that, when Secretary of State Clinton talked about sort of the three Ds. Diplomacy and defense and development. She didn't talk about democracy so much, and there hasn't been a lot of talk from Obama about democracy promotion. And I think that this is even more important when you consider how much damage was done to sort of the U.S. brand on democracy promotion during the Bush years. It's really important, I think, for a U.S. president to talk about sort of where democracy fits into our vision of what American foreign policy is about and what it can accomplish. And I haven't got a real sense of that to date. So I think it's. And I hope that I'm wrong, and it's very possible that I am wrong. I'm just not sensing a great deal of attention to it. I also go back and say also that during the campaign, I think that there a sense of a lot of people I talked to that the administration was a little more focused on failed states and fixing failed states and the economic side of development than they were on the political side of development. And I think that is a mistake as well.
This might be a good time to transition to part two.
Sure.
Which is here is where the linkage might be. Might be a bit of a stretch, but one person in the administration who is stressing who does stress sort of civilian capacity building is one Robert Gates.
Yes.
Who's on many occasions the Secretary of Defense has. Called for a more robust capacity to be built inside the State Department and, frankly, inside USAID. We talked earlier, but USAID does not have a substantial expeditionary capacity.
Yes.
Doesn't have a lot of I believe what capacity they do have is in the Office of Transition Initiative to go
right.
into failed or failing states and try to do development work there. But there aren't a lot of development experts within USAID as, the reasons you just discussed to do that kind of work,
right?
So this kind of brings me into another one of Gates's priorities, which is something that you've been quite critical of, which is this idea of shifting DoD capacity toward doing more counterinsurgency mm-hmm. and less sort of traditional war fighting. And, you know, I'd actually, this is a good point to plug Spencer Ackerman, who is a blogging head, you know, semi-regular, and who's been chronicling this shift towards counterinsurgency mm-hmm. within the Defense Department, and you know, has really done an excellent job of chronicling this this phenomenon. And I'm wondering, so you, Michael, what is your beef?
Where do
what
I
is
start?
Your beef with with counterinsurgency and this shift?
I mean, my view, there's sort of two elements to this, but, you know, my primary beef with counterinsurgency is I don't think we should be fighting counterinsurgencies. I think that you fight a counterinsurgency when you've already put yourself in a pretty big hole. And the counterinsurgency's success, and I use that word very loosely in Iraq, you know, in the last 2 years, I think it was a transitory success. I think you're already seeing the problems with the uptick in violence and the still lack of great political reconciliation. You know, the issue here is a little bit that we forget why we had to do counterinsurgency in the first place, which is that we got involved in a war we shouldn't have gotten involved with, and we spent 4 years sort of mucking up the situation in Irak, and only do we come up with a strategy after sort of everything else has sort of failed. And I think that the lesson there is not to draw from the last 2 years and the supposed success, but the first 4 years of the war. And the idea that these types of conflicts, of long-term military engagements, are not in the U.S. Comparative military advantage, I would argue. And that we should be fighting less wars, not more wars. And to me, counterinsurgency and enshrining it as a doctrine in the U.S. military is a recipe for more wars. And there is a view among folks like John Nagel and others, that we're fighting a long war with Islamic extremists. I don't agree with that at all. I think we're fighting a short to near-term conflict with al-Qaeda. And we should be focusing on that particular enemy and not lumping all Islamic extremists in with al-Qaeda and with their sort of ideology.
But I guess, you know, you can make sure, you know, Iraq, you know, is a war. You know, we shouldn't invade and occupy countries for no reason, right? I mean, I don't think, you know, you have no, you know, quarrel with me there. But to play devil's advocate a little bit, you know, it would seem that if the United States, in its initial, you know, occupation, I guess you can call it, of Afghanistan, or its initial, you know, intervention in Afghanistan, could have perhaps done a little bit, you know, better by itself than if it were to adopt principles of counterinsurgency from the outset. Perhaps we wouldn't, you know, be facing such an insurgency as the United States is facing now in Afghanistan.
I'm not so sure that would be. Like, I mean, from my perspective, that there's a counterterrorism goal in Afghanistan, which is to basically wipe out Al Qaeda and what they're known as the Taliban. As far as doing counterinsurgency, which basically creates a massive U.S. military footprint, which involves basically nation building, let's call it what it is nation building. I don't really think that's a better solution for Afghanistan, just as well as a good solution for Iraq. This kind of commitment involves a long-term military commitment that I don't think this country is willing to do, and I don't think that we should be doing. I don't think it's our national interest to be doing it. I think what's interesting about the president's recent Afghanistan policy is it reflects I think much more of a counterterrorism strategy than a counterinsurgency strategy, of basically mm-hmm. looking for the exit in Afghanistan. You want to build up the Afghan security services. You want to degrade al-Qaeda's military advantage, military capabilities, degrade Taliban's military capabilities, maybe find some diplomatic engagement with elements of the Taliban, but find a way to get out. Counterinsurgency is a recipe for staying for a very long time, in my view. But the other point that really worries me about counterinsurgency is I think you're militarizing foreign policy. I mean, the simple reality is that, you know, there's a difference between phase four operations, which come after the war has begun and the war is finished, and phase zero operations. And phase zero operations are, of course, before conflict emerges. And that's, in my view, where civilian agencies should be relied upon to a greater extent. And it's funny because you hear Gates and others in the military say we have to give more money to state and build up the civilian capacity. And I believe their intentions are pure. But they'll also say, you know, I hear from other people who will say, well, look, AID can't do these kind of operations. They don't have the capability to do it. It's sort of a chicken and egg, kind of a catch-22 situation. And still, the military wants to build up their own capacity. I mean, like AFRICOM being one example of this. So I'm not necessarily convinced that that this strategy is not going to lead to DOD and the military being the leading end of the spear when it comes to U.S. foreign policy. And it seems to me that's a mistake, and it's not what our military should be doing. It's also not the right image we should be sending to the world. Our military is, as an Air Force general said to me a couple weeks ago, the least democratic institution in American society. It should not be the focal point of how we promote democracy and how we do development around the world. And the fact that we are now at 22% of development going through DOD is, I think, a good suggestion of how much this pendulum has swung towards the Defense Department. And I know with great irony, by the way, that we're arguing over a $650 billion defense budget, and yet we're seeing in the Hill, until actually Gates stepped in, cuts to the international affairs budget, which is, I think, around $80 billion. So the difference in numbers here is striking. And I think, again, to go back to my original argument about AID, part of the problem is that I don't think development democracy does not have a seat at the table. And that's part of the problem also. They're not in the National Security Council meetings basically, you know, providing their side of the issue. And they're not able to really advocate for the budgetary resources that they need. So I really think that until you change that fundamental dynamic, and build up those civilian agencies in a really significant way, you're not going to take it away from the military. The military will always find ways to build up their own budgets and to increase their own capacity and to play a role, you know, all over the world if they have to.
Right, but, you know, it seems like, you know, part of your, you know, the reason, you know, that Gates and others might be, you know, allies of yours in creating, you know, a more robust civilian capacity and more funding for things like USAID is, I think, precisely because, you know, Gates realizes the Defense Department doesn't have, you know, the capacity or the expertise to do, you know, what USAID does, and they need that expertise in the field in places like Afghanistan. And I'm reminded of a sort of semi-famous anecdote of a commander of a PRT, you know, the Provincial Reconstruction Team,
sure,
in Afghanistan, you know, building a well in a village. As a reward for that village, giving the commander some, you know, useful intelligence information.
Right.
So the well was dug, the village was happy. Meanwhile, a village, you know, down, you know, a few miles away, saw their own wells dry up, and they thought, and it, you know, because they thought that you know, the Defense Department was doing this intentionally, that the American government was doing this intentionally to punish them, and you know. It, as it turns out, there was not, you know, a water expert there, presumably
right.
A water expert that would have been, you know, at the USAID on hand to, you know, conduct a water table analysis to make sure that this kind of, you know, quick impact, I guess you could call it counterinsurgency minded operation was done effectively.
Mm.
So I guess, you know, it seems that you know, to the extent that you're going to do these kinds of operations, the extent that we want to do some sort of nation building in Afghanistan, you need this civilian capacity on hand.
I would say about this is that, you know, it's funny because you talk to a lot of the counterinsurgency people and they say, yeah, we really want to build up civilian capacity. But in a way, what I hear from them, they want to build up civilian capacity to help them do counterinsurgency. In other words, they recognize, and wisely so, that the military can't do this alone. And a lot of this is part of the civilians need to play a leading role, and in fairness, they all make that point, and they get that. The problem is that, to me, it's all sort of supporting what is basically a military focused approach to foreign policy, which is to basically think of this as some kind of long war in which our military is going to be engaged in a kinetic environment. And I just think that's where the mistakes sort of set in. I think that we should be thinking about development and democracy in the larger context of not just environments that are necessarily failed states or environments that are in turmoil, but those places that are actually functioning democracies or fledgling democracies that need our assistance. And this is another point I get to in the report that's very, very important. You know, we focus so much energy on the worst of the worst, but we don't focus enough energy in those places where we can actually make a real difference. I mean, you know, Jordan and Morocco are places where getting assistance from us can actually move that move those countries in a positive direction, build institutions that will lead to better governance and to stronger democratic institutions. I mean, Indonesia had an election this week. You know, who would have, if I told you 10 or 15 years ago that Indonesia would be a relatively stable and functioning multi-party democracy, would have thought I was crazy. But you don't hear a lot about that. You hear about the failed states and the ones that are having problems. And I think one of the recognitions that I wanted to make in this report was to say, look, it's not just a question of we can't be everywhere we want to be. We have to use our resources appropriately, and we have to use them in such a way that it actually fulfills our interests. And we have to use them in a way where they're actually effective. And I think, you know, one thing about MCC that I like is that it actually looks at countries that are more likely to take assistance and use it in an effective way. And for the countries that are on the lower end of the development scale, we need to think about how do we provide the technical assistance that they need to develop capacity to build up institutions. And maybe money isn't what they need right now. Maybe it's more technical capacity that a really, you know, effective development agency could provide.
It seems that how failed states become unfailed is through, is through nation building. I mean, you have examples like, you know, East Timor, Liberia, Haiti is still stuck, but examples of countries who have become unstuck, who have become unfailed, like Sierra Leone. Maybe another good example of that. And, right. You know, it is nation building. That is how they do it. The difference, however, I think, is that, you know, this maybe gets to my own sort of niche, which is that, you know, it's the UN doing the nation building. It's not a single country, namely the United States, that's you know, trying to do it all on its own. And it seems to me that a lot of this discussion over counterinsurgency and nation building is sort of we're talking a bit about how to fight the last war, and not enough about, you know, how, you know, presumably for the foreseeable future, Americans are not going to want to, get into more entanglements along the lines of Iraq and Afghanistan. But, you know, there's still going to be a need out there for someone to do something, say Somalia might be a good example. And it seems to me that we might as well empower other governments to take on a greater share of the responsibility to do that. And, you know, the UN, at least, you know, from my experience, seems to be a good vehicle, and a vehicle, frankly, a track record of doing these things right.
Listen, I completely agree with that. And one of the points we make in the report is to say that we need to flow more of our democracy assistance money through the UN. Well, A, it's one way to depoliticize it. But B, I think the UN is an effective conduit for getting to local actors, to NGOs on the ground who actually can use these resources in an effective way. And I think, to your point, we don't do well at nation building. It's not a core competency of the U.S. And it needs to be a multilateral effort and a multivariate effort. It's not just even a question of governments. It's international organizations. It's also philanthropists. It's also private companies, private organizations, private foundations. It's a really multivariate approach. And we need to recognize in how we do assistance that there's lots of different actors at work here, lots of different groups on the ground who are doing this, and we need to be supporting the ones that I think like local NGOs and civil society that build up the elements of the building blocks of a democracy. And one of the points I make in the report is that we spent way too much time in this country thinking about individuals and not institutions. And we don't think enough about how we build up civil society and use that as the focal point for building up democracy. And I think we would know from our own experience, it takes an empowered citizenry to make a democracy succeed and to turn an authoritarian or semi-authoritarian regime to a democratic regime. And we've seen countless examples of this. So I think that a recognition of our own limitations, recognition of where aid can be effective, is really the starting point for this conversation. And once we can do that, once we can recognize that we can't go into countries and turn them into Jeffersonian democracies overnight, and that assistance is not going to turn a country into a democracy, in 1 year or 2 years, it may take a generation to do. Once we kind of have that recognition about the elements of what builds up a democracy, then you can design, I think, assistance programs that are much more effective and that are more focused on what really is, as I said before, a long-term objective of our foreign policy, which is to build up democracies and to support countries that are on that trajectory towards better governance.
Great. Well, thank you very much, Michael. Maybe we should leave it there just in case this part of the conversation is is erased for forever. But thanks.
The video seems to be working better.
Okay.
Now,
well, so thanks again.